quite well, actually.
Got a good mic here, then.
Yeah, it's actually it's like that. It picks up from either side.
Oh, I see. I'm very hoarse today for some reason, although I haven't got a cold or anything, but I just seem to...
You started in 29.
Yeah.
And did you go right away into the lab?
Yeah, I just graduated, you see, in chemical engineering. And I was brought in as assistant to Robert Boyd, who was at that time the chief chemist.
Mm-hmm. And then you stayed in the lab right the way after, right the way through?
Oh yeah, I mean, my career was with what was, and I presume may still be known as the technical control department, but mm-hmm. Mr. Boyd was head of that, and I was brought in as his assistant.
Yeah.
It's rather interesting that prior to 1929, Mr. Boyd was the only employee with an academic degree, and I was number two.
I noticed that. And what were your duties when you first started?
Went in there as a bench chemist and mm-hmm. Worked up to take over the supervision of the lab. And then when the company bought into the beet sugar operation, and Mr. Boyd was promoted to general superintendent in 1931, which involved a complete supervision of all the operations of the company, which at that time embraced the Raymond factory and the refinery, and I was directly under him. I became chief chemist and was responsible for the technical control of the refinery and until Mr. Boyd died in 1951.
Did you stay in that position afterwards?
Well, then after he died, his responsibilities were divided up. Excuse me. And I was promoted to general chemist, which gave me the overall technical supervision of all the refineries, all the company's operations, the beet sugar stuff, and also at that time we had the peace going in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Boyd's, because of his long association and with the company, his span of operations not only was technical as general superintendent, he became involved in planning and labor relations. He did the labor negotiations, you know, when the original when they originally set up a union in 1943, and his duties had become
complex.
Oh, wide range of things were quite apart from the technical side of things.
Yeah.
And so when he died, his responsibilities were divided up. His bit on the labor side went to Reg Clark, who had been brought in to become personnel manager anyway. And Forrest Rogers really took over the title of general superintendent, but Peter was the assistant general superintendent, and really did the spade work. Peter was pretty young in those days, and I guess they didn't feel that they could just pass on it was a sort of number three job in the organization. And I was given the control of the laboratories and the technical control. And this is the angle that I worked on for the rest of my career with the company.
You were quite happy to stay on the technical side of it, were you?
Oh yes, I mean that was my life, and
You didn't want to be like Boyd.
Well, I don't think it was even possible because Peter had come into the company as a student, and he's a very brilliant fellow, and he was being trained to become the general superintendent. he would have succeeded. Mr. Boyd, died a year before he was due to retire.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the company had never come to grips with his retirement, and so there had been no sort of preparation for where I would fit into the picture. All it was more or less laid on that in due course Peter would become general superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
And my outlook was completely on the technical side of things, and I'd had nothing to do with labor negotiations per se, and so on.
And Peter told me that he suggested that he was not very brilliant. He said, "I managed to scrape through engineering degree sort of thing." Is that just false modesty?
Oh yeah, sure. Now he may not have made any great marks because he's fellow that probably had a lot of other interests, though I think he did pretty well.
Mm.
But he's got a very bright mind, and anybody that worked at the refinery, I knew him better, because after Mr. Boyd died, Peter and I ran together very much in the operations side. We used to spend most of our time on the Perry operations together, because
mm-hmm.
I had the technical, chemical side of the background, which he didn't have, and he had the mechanical side. And of course he had the organizing side of the plants as general superintendent. He wasn't doing routine engineering. He's a mechanical engineer, of course,
mm-hmm.
but he knew the mechanics, and he had a pretty good idea of the chemical side of things. But Royce Craig was the chief engineer, and he looked after the engineering, and I looked after the chemical side of things. And Peter was the coordinator, of course, mm-hmm. in his position.
Yeah.
So he's quite a modest fellow, and I'm quite sure he wouldn't make any claim to fame as a student. I don't think he set any academic records really when he was out there, but he wasn't stupid, I can assure you. And
yeah.
If you've run into him at all in your work, he's just like a damn bear trap, you know.
Yeah, I have. I wonder I still got my feet. He's pretty sharp. But can you think of any particular instances which demonstrate his particular talents?
God, that's a tough one to throw at me right now, because there are probably so many of them, and I just can't recall them offhand.
Yeah. Well, we could leave it and come bring it up again
later.
We're talking about when we're making a record which is not of any immediate interest, but it's going to be listened to in maybe 50 years.
Sure.
And so I'm interested to get opinions of.
Doesn't pull any punches when he's there. But.
Yeah. Does he ever fly off the handle? I get the impression sometimes that he has a bit of a short fuse.
Oh, I guess on rare occasions he. Like, I suppose all of us get sort of sore once in a while. I must say I tend to forget these incidents, though I have the odd tangle with them on occasion. But,
yeah.
But we are always very good friends, I mean, and Fari is like that too. Fari can get mad just like that, you know, and then calm down afterwards, and be rather apologetic for it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we all have that sort of.
Yeah, no, I guess I'm just the same. Boyd is a man I've heard a lot about, and I've been looking forward to talking to you, because I figured you probably know him pretty well.
Well, he was a man that nobody knew very well. Peter would know him as well as I did. Peter lived in the staff house in the Perrys with him, you know, for the 2-3 years before Mr. Boyd died. He was a very interesting character in many ways. He was academically, he was a pretty bright fellow that had not been brought up to get into what they would call in England a works chemist.
Mm-hmm.
He had, his training was quite academic, and he had done research with some pretty eminent research men in England and Scotland before I came to Canada. And you come out to Canada, I believe about 1911, I can't give you the exact dates, to be on the staff of the chemistry department at the University of Toronto. And while he was there, B.C. Sugar, probably Mr. B.T. Rogers, was looking for a chemist, and they sent down east. I don't know what the circumstances were. And he came out, and I think he joined the company in 1912. You can verify the dates, but that's about that time. And he started to apply his knowledge in a much more practical sense when he became chief chemist at the refinery. And he did a lot of interesting things around the place. For instance, he developed the golden syrup. Yet at that time, there was no market for molasses, and they were, on occasions, they were dumping it into the sea to get rid of the damn stuff. They couldn't sell it. Mm-hmm. It had to be got rid of. And so anything that they could do to absorb molasses into a product was something that was worthwhile. And so golden syrup came into that category, and he got that thing going.
Was it, do you know, was it his suggestion?
Oh, I wouldn't know for sure. Mm. But he certainly did the development work. I'm not sure it was his idea, probably.
Yeah, because it was at that time being sold in England, wasn't it?
Well, of course, Lyell's golden syrup goes back in history, the middle of the 19th century. Mm. And it was a product that was being imported into Canada. Mm. And Mr. Boyd would undoubtedly have been exposed to Lyell syrup, and then there was a Tate syrup too, which was made by the Tates. See, there were two separate corporations in England in the sugar business before Tate and Lyell became established. And Tates had a refinery up at Liverpool, and they were making some sort of a syrup, and you can make any kind of syrup you want within limits of flavor and so on. So I'm pretty sure that the idea was pushed by Mr. Boyd, whether he actually told Mr. Rogers, well, you better make golden syrup, or Mr. Rogers said, well, can we make golden syrup? But anyway, he was responsible for getting the process going. And originally the inversion was done with sulfuric acid at high temperature and very rapidly, causing a lot of color formation, and so they would invert the golden syrup, and then it was put over char filters again to cover the color. Started work in the probably around 1919, would be about that time, but Frank Shove had a lot to do with the developing of the processes they use it today, where they are now doing the inversion with invertase, and under much more gentle conditions, and so they don't get the color formation and so on, better control of the of the inversion, and all it takes a longer time, it's done at lower temperature and so on.
When did Frank Shove come into the picture?
Well, I think originally about 1917, he was there before BT died, and then he had an accident to his knee, and he left the employ of the company for some months, now I don't know how long, and I think it was while he was away on this thing that BT died, and he came back to the company. It had nothing to do with Mr. Rogers anyway, but I mean, I'm just trying to get the dates in there.
Yeah.
And he became Mr. Boyd's right-hand man in the lab, you see, and he was a guy that had good abilities on getting things done. He was a good fellow that way. Sometimes trod a lot of people's feet when he was doing it, but never mind, he got the...
Was he an academic chemist too?
No, he was just a graduate out of high school. He had a... he never went to university. Mm. And then Wilfred Kenyon came there somewhere about 1920. I'm not sure if it was 20 or 21, and Wilfred will tell you all about his background. And he worked in the lab as a bench chemist, and he also...
Was he at school?
No, he was a fellow that he never went to the university, but he had some experience in dye works in England, and he knew a little bit about laboratory work. And he also did a lot of learned a lot himself by going to night school and that sort of thing. So he was a pretty competent fellow. He would be classed as a technician today. But he was a fellow that was ambitious and interested in his work, and they were quite a pair. Frank was the guy that was that pushed his way around, and Wilfred was the fellow with the smooth tongue, you see. And they both got their results in entirely different ways.
Yeah, I see. Okay, and. Let's go back. I'm interested in the development of the syrup. What exactly did Boyd develop in 1911-12, whenever it was?
Well, he developed this process of extracting the material like they do today in the process, and it was accumulated, and after the melt was in, they would take this material up to the blow-ups, and they would do the inversion in the blow-ups. It was done very rapidly, and with not too much control, because they didn't have the means of controlling stuff like they have now. And then it was filtered. They used sulfuric acid and lime, and you got a precipitate of calcium sulfate, which they filtered out on the filter presses, and then the clear syrup went through the char filter to take the color out again, went down to the pan, the vacuum pans like it does today, and to be thickened up, and that was it. But as I say, it was a very rigorous sort of inversion, and the control was so rapid there was no really good means of control.
Yeah, I see. And did he figure this out because he knew the way Tate and Lyle's did it, or was it a new
Tate and Lyle's process was completely secret, and I don't think anybody outside of Tate and Lyle's today really knows exactly what goes on. We know approximately what they must do to achieve what they're getting, because these are well known reactions that take place.
Yeah, I see. And so Boyd really developed, just worked out a process of doing it.
Sure.
I see. Yeah. And then you say that Frank showed, did he work with Boyd on developing the process that you use now?
Yeah.
He didn't do it all by himself.
Oh, no.
He worked with Boyd.
Oh, yeah, sure. So Boyd was the brains.
Boyd was the brains.
And Frank was working under his direction.
Yeah, I see.
And I, Wilfred may have also been involved in that golden syrup bit in the early 20s, and he could tell you more about it, because, I say, he was there about the time they got that thing going.
I see. Okay, well, I'll ask him about that.
Sure. Now, another thing that Robert Boyd did, which was a very interesting thing, when the First World War broke out, they were using phosphate defecation in purifying the solutions, and these old bag filters that undoubtedly you've heard people talk about in one of those pictures, and this was a messy thing. The process was to take the washed raw liquor and you added phosphoric acid, or what they were really adding was a calcium acid phosphate, which was imported from England, and this was added to your solution, and then the alkalinity was adjusted to with litmus paper to approximate neutrality. Now, litmus paper wasn't a very precise way of determining alkalinity, but it was used. That was all that was available, as a matter of fact. And when the First World War broke out, the supply of this calcium phosphate acid, this calcium acid phosphate, was stopped. And so phosphoric acid became rather difficult. Well, they had lots of phosphate around the refinery in the form of bone char. You see, bone char is about 80% calcium phosphate in its structure. So they have the phosphate ion there, and this could be converted to phosphoric acid by a reaction with sulfuric acid, and you produce. And he developed this process. It was a wet process, but before they got that established, phosphoric acid is produced commercially by an electric furnace, and this electric furnace bit was, I guess, pretty recent. I can't give you the history of that, but it's in the technical books. And he and Harry Pavey did a lot of experimental work on trying to produce phosphoric acid by fusion of the Bolchar phosphate with an electric arc. And they played around with that for some years, I understand, without much success. But they got this wet process going, and we had that acid plant in the refinery until, I guess, the 1954, when they built the present office. The acid plant was down where, behind what is the garage. I don't know what you call it today. You got your computer center in there, one thing or another.
Yeah.
And this was, it's in all the pictures.
Yeah, I know that story.
Yeah, and it was a four-story structure, you see, and they have the reaction tank up at the top, and they put the Bolchar up there and reacted it with sulfuric acid and chewed it up, and then you filtered out. They had a calcium sulfate precipitate, you see, which was discarded, and they had a wooden filter press. I guess it's been destroyed, but it would have been a unique thing to keep. And then the acid in a dilute form, it was, I don't know, 5 or 7% P2O5. And this then was carried over to the filter house, where they had the tank up on the top of the filter house. And I guess they had one in the old melt house, because we used the phosphoric acid in the inversion of the golden syrup. But this stuff, they probably told you about the Black Mariah that they had. It was a great big wood stave tank. It was a section of wood stave pipe with ends put into it, and a very, very massive steel girders put across the ends, because they used the thing as an egg to blow the acid up. They put compressed air on the top and blow the acid up to the top of the ninth floor of the filter house. It was a hell of a pressure. You know, it took, I guess they were using 100 psi air, and so with these flat ends, they had to brace them, and they have these 6-inch I-beams across the end of the thing with tie rods to hold the thing together from blowing, and the wheels on that thing, and Forrest will tell you all about this. They came off one of the first cars, the Pierce Arrow that the Rogers. I think that's where they came from, or they may have come off one of the first trucks. But it was they were these old wheels and the old axles, you know, on the damn thing. So that's another thing that got destroyed, which, you know, should have been kept
same story in every department of their mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, nobody wanted the damn things. And
the lab has a very good record, though. You kept some old Polariscopes.
Oh yes, yeah. We were the squirrels around the place, and of course Mr. Boyd had set up a pretty good recording system. Actually, they had good recording of all the sugar ships coming in, and the lab have records that go back to 1900, I'm sure, up there, if not before, on the ship's cargoes that came in. The polarizations used to be in some ledgers that were up there.
Yeah,
I don't think they've ever been thrown away.
Yeah, I'm going to see Malcolm shortly about what's up there. He sort of replaced you, did he?
Well, you know, it's like Mr. Boyd, when he died, his job was to divide it three ways. So I like to kid everybody, it took 4 men to take over my job. So Malcolm took over. You see, my job became more and more complex as time went on, just like Mr. Boyd's had done. And number one, I'm not an analyst by training, though I learned chemical analysis in the course of my training as a chemical engineer. So I know the background, but analytic procedures had changed radically and become much more modernized, and I was quite incapable of keeping up to what was going on. And Alan Nielsen came in there as my assistant just before Mr. Boyd died, and Alan had no interest in analytical work. He'd been brought up as a chemical engineer, and I guess by the time he went through in chemical engineering, the analytical bit had been soft-pedaled a lot, you know. And he wasn't interested in it, so there was no really good direction for the lab. So Malcolm, I persuaded Forrest and Peter that really if they wanted to keep abreast of things, they got to have somebody that was specialized in this thing, and it just so happened that Malcolm was available, and he's a very capable analyst, and he knows the technical background of analytical procedures, and so that's how he came in. Well, then Alan became interested in other things in the plant, and he wasn't interested in the plant control particularly, which is to some extent, I suppose, a routine bit. You pound the beat. I always enjoyed going out in the plant and seeing what the hell was going on, finding out what was wrong. And he didn't like that too much, so it was when we got Ken Fu to come in and take over the sort of the plant supervision bit on the technical supervision of the plant. It had nothing to do with the labor and anything like that.
Is he a school-trained chemist, or...?
Oh yeah, he's a chemical engineer.
Okay, let me just check that I got this correct. See, one of the things I'm trying to pursue is the sort of original work that's been done at the refinery, which has been done totally as a matter of course, and nobody ever thought that it's maybe of historic interest.
Sure.
And I've only gradually become aware that in many departments you've been pretty thoroughly original, and it's just you do it, and you'd be in the Guinness Book of Records if a historian had anything to say.
Sure.
okay, that's two things, and we haven't got beyond the First World War.
Yeah.
Can you give me other illustrations of his originality or your, original things that were done?
When BT died, then Blythe became president. Blythe had some association with his father and the company, and had done some work around the lab and one thing or another. He was the only one of the Rogers boys that really, up to that time, had had any association in the refinery itself. And when he died in 1919, I think it was, his brother Ernest, who was later president, was brought back, and I think Ernie was about 21 when his father died, and he had been overseas during the First World War, and I'm sure that this is all a matter of record down there anyway. He didn't know anything about the business, and he was a very interesting character, because while he'd been brought up at private schools and so on, the old man wouldn't send the boys to university. So neither Ernie or Blythe had the opportunity to go to university, and the war had intervened. Ernie became determined to learn the business, and not only from the financial side, but from the technical side, became extremely interested in the technical side of the operation. And so when Blythe died, and Fordham Johnson became president, Fordham Johnson didn't know one end of the refinery from the other, didn't know what side was up. But he was a good financial man, and knew the financial side of the operation very well. So Ernie started to learn sugar technology the hard way, by reading books and so on. And Mr. Boyd was his mentor, and encouraged him, and he worked very heart of Mr. Boyd, and he very rarely realized that the work in the refinery was very sloppy. And Mr. Boyd was rather anxious to get things improved and put in what was later called technical control. So about 1924-25, they had need to expand the filter house because it was a bottleneck, as far as I know. And they employed, they were on very good terms with the CNH refinery in California. And they got CNH to lend them their chief chemist, who was a man named A.A. Blowski, B-L-O-W-S-K-I, who was a top-notch technical man. And he came up and spent a fair amount of time in Vancouver and helped them design, I think, the extensions to the filter house. But more important, he did a survey of their losses and the extravagances that went on in the plant due to poor control, and he made a report which is on record down at the refinery. I think Peter probably has it, because I had it in my files for many years, and I know I passed it on to Peter or Forey. And more or less supported what Mr. Boyd had recommended. And so in 1926, I think it was, they really started putting some technical control into the refinery under Mr. Boyd's direction and by the instigation of Bernie, who was vice president. Bernie had a fair amount of authority around the place, and so this is how they got that going. So this was another contribution that Mr. Boyd made that provided the basis for the technical control that even exists today. Now I know the details have changed and so on, but the concept was there, and he done this. And Wilford can give you a lot more of the background of that introduction, because when I got there in 29, they already had done a lot of work to improve the operating efficiency through proper technical control.
Yeah.
And Wilford has been much involved in that.
And this sort of by technical control, can you just tell me in a few sentences exactly what is involved?
Well, it's the application of scientific facts and figures to plant performance. And I mean, you analyze your materials that are going through and find out what you were absorbing and what you were losing, and cutting down on the amount of sugar that went down the sewer couldn't be accounted for, and operating efficiency like on centrifugal machines, keeping records of production, for instance, the amount of sweet water that was produced. And every time you produce sweet water, you take fuel to evaporate the water, so they cut down on the amount of water that was being used in the plant, and got their evaporator load down where they were running two evaporators full out most of the week to one evaporator on a part-time basis, you see. So these are all very important to the welfare of the company from a production point of view. And so this was the sort of thing that went on. And Frank Shope and Wilford Kenyon were very much involved in that phase of the operations when I went there. And of course, I was given the indoctrination into the same thing, and I worked on a lot of that for the first couple of years I was there. And then, of course, when I became chief chemist, I had much more sort of office responsibility, because I was in charge of the technical records and producing technical reports and so on. So, but I still had my association in the refinery as a supervising technologist, I suppose you would call it today.
Yeah. So No, that's this is very useful. After technical control, somebody's been talking to me about pH process or something.
pH.
pH. Was that developed at the refinery, or is that just
no,
a standard?
No. pH was a scientific oddity about, I suppose, in 1917 or something like that, and it made a theoretical or practical contribution to the control of alkalinity and acidity. It is a way of measuring acidity and alkalinity on an ionic basis. And it's too complicated for me to try and describe it to you, but it gave a much more scientific background for the control of alkalinities in the refinery. Now, the refinery normally works at about neutrality, but if you get acid, if the materials become acid, and there's always a tendency for sugar materials to become acid when they're in the liquid state, then you get inversion, because the easiest way to invert sugar is to apply acid to it, and you knock down the alkalinity or you increase the acidity. But if you keep it alkaline, this tendency it almost disappears. I wouldn't say that you can't get inversion, but it doesn't occur easily. But if you get things too alkaline, then the alkali starts to darken the sugar solutions. It tends to chew up sugar in a different way than the acid. And so you work as close to neutrality as you can. And in the pH scale, you have numbers from 1 to 14. And 7 is neutrality. And anything below 7 is acid, and anything above 7 is alkaline. And the lower the number, the more acid it is. The higher the number, the more alkaline it is. And so at pH 14, you've got ultimate in alkaline ionic action, you see. And at pH 1, you've got the maximum acidic ionic.
It's turned into syrup at that point.
Well, no. This has nothing to do with syrup. Nothing to do with sugar. This is a chemical. This is a chemistry thing, but applied to the refining operation. It got away from the litmus paper trying to, you know, what litmus paper is. And if it's alkaline, it's blue, and if it's acid, it's red. You see. Well, it was a pretty wide range of alkalinity that litmus paper has. You might have had a pH of 8, and it would show just almost red, which would show it was acid, you see. And by the same token, you might have a blue piece of litmus paper, and it might have been alkaline at that, just close to the neutral point. So this was a very easy way of, or more accurate way, I should say, of controlling alkalinities. And originally the way you measured the alkalinity was by the color created by the ionic action between acid and alkali with certain dyes. And it's all well recorded in the laboratory, and if you go after Malcolm, he can give you lots of details if you want to get into it. But originally, when this thing was set up, it was done on the basis of the recommendations of Blavsky, who had set the thing up for CNH, you see, and I guess BC Sugar was probably the second refinery in the world that got onto pH control for the process. And this was done by making standards of known alkalinities with dyes in them, and you had a range of colors over, you probably had maybe 8 test tubes of different degrees of depth of color, you know, say on pink range if you happen to be using phenyl red, which was one of the dyes that we used, and which was one of the ranges that was useful to us because it worked from pH 6, 8 to pH 8.4, so we had a nice range there. Then we had another one with Prothymol Blue that was, I don't know, pH 7.4 down to pH 6, I think it was. And we used to, these things were not available commercially, and we had to make our own color standards, and Mr. Boyd had Wilfred, I think Wilfred did a lot of the work on this, and Frank Shove too, in preparing chemicals. And you couldn't buy chemicals pure enough that you could make these standards from, so they would have to buy the best laboratory chemicals they could, and then they would recrystallize them and repurify them and so on to get the good. So this was another angle of pure chemistry that went on in the lab that nobody outside the lab understood it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's people in the lab didn't understand it either.
And precisely at what point in the refinery would you be using this sort of conductor?
Well, they eventually set up testing stations all around the refinery.
Mm-hmm.
And starting in the melt house, and they had one at the blow-ups, one at the sweetening station, one in the old liquor gallery, and later one down in the what they called the engine room. This was the where the tanks were in connection with the pan house, and I'm sure you've run into the engine room, because this was the attendant down there is supposed to look after the engines, which were the originally, of course, they had prime movers that with belts and line shafts and everything, and they had two of these they had two ideal engines down there. They were,
mm-hmm.
But the other ones, what the hell were they? Fari mentioned the name the other day. Anyway, you can find that out without any difficulty. That worked all the machinery in the plant. It was all done by belts and line shafts from here to yonder, you see, until eventually everything was electrified and so on. So the engine room attendant was down there, and all he had to do was watch these things. So the runoff tanks, which are now on the fourth floor of the pan house, which received the syrups from the from the sugar. But this was all down on the ground floor, which was the original refinery building. The engine room was in there, and this tank room was, I think the char filter had been in there in the original setup.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all these tanks, and boy, they were just piled in and higgledy-piggledy. It was a hell of a mess. But we had the runoff syrups, and we were controlling the alkalinity, and we had a testing station down there. So they had these little testing stations, and the operators were taught to use the testing equipment to maintain the proper conditions in the refinery.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well that's pretty interesting. I just got a lead on the pH process about which I'd hardly heard from Art Elms. I asked him offhand the same sort of question, what contributions do you think to sugar technology have been made at the refinery?
Mm-hmm.
And he's probably not the right person to ask, but I asked him anyway.
Oh, well, sure, you can ask everybody.
Well, this is it. I just send sort of similar questions to everybody and see what I get. And he mentioned that and various other processes. So obviously I get more on them from you. Okay, so that's that brings us up to the 30s. Is the next thing to talk about the Hyrite process? Or is there something
in
between?
Yes, it is another thing that came on about that time. Because the company were up against this problem of very bad colors in their soft sugars, and they were meeting competition from the eastern refiners at the Saskatchewan-Manitoba border, and of course it was anathema to the management to have an eastern sugar come into their territory.
Yeah.
The territory was largely defined by the freight rates, and I'm sure this has been explained to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And unless somebody cut their price, it wasn't economically possible to move Montreal sugar to Saskatchewan, or for BC sugar to move sugar in the Manitoba, you see, mm-hmm. because that's where the cutoff was on, yeah. on freights, and if the price of sugar in quoted in Montreal the same as in Vancouver, which it should be approximately, there was no way this could happen. Mm-hmm. But the eastern refiners were always trying to push sugar into Saskatchewan, and they would do this by selling specialties like soft sugar and so on into the Saskatchewan market. And they used to make a bit of a deal out of the rather poor shades of color that the BC sugar, soft sugars had. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with them from a nutritional point of view, but you know, the eye has some appeal, and mm-hmm. the people could be swayed mm-hmm. if the two sugars were side by side, and one looked like mud, and the other one didn't, you know, which one you'd buy.
Yeah.
So this was a great chase that was going on even when I first went there to try and improve the colors, and we did a lot of experimental work. Mm-hmm. And most of this is pretty well on record, unless somebody's thrown out the books in the lab, because there's just reams and reams of reports up there that are prepared by Wilfred Kenyon, by Frank Shove, by Bill Murdoch, by Bill Banks, and a few by Alan Nielsen, mm-hmm. Covering quite a range of things that we became interested in. Mm-hmm. And in 1935, there was the first paper on ion exchange using these organic resins, as they were called, was published in a magazine called Chemistry and Industry, and they should have them all bound copies. Mm-hmm. We eventually quit taking it because it became too complicated and nobody was reading them, so I canceled the thing. Mm-hmm. But in those days, the technical literature was a damn sight simpler than it was today. And Boyd belonged to the Society of Chemical Industry, which published this magazine. It was a weekly technical magazine from England, and it had first-class reports on things. And this paper had come out. Holmes and Adams, or Adams and Holmes, had experimented with reacting formaldehyde and phenol, I think it was, some phenolic compounds anyway, and found that they had this rather unique property of being able to absorb ash constituents. And so this really fired up Boyd's imagination, and we started to experiment with this stuff, and on a very primitive basis in the lab, turning these things out, and by God, we found that